The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Zan Brooks, and in this week's show, we'll be ushering you into the director's chair for a new series of special interviews called, fittingly enough, In the Director's Chair.
With Bend It Like Beckham, that still took about 5 years to get that financed. I mean, you know, that was a long haul. Most people felt that no one wanted to see a film about an Indian girl who wants to play football.
Yes, Jason Solomons met up with British director Gurinder Chadha to discuss her career to date and her latest picture, Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging. And if that weren't enough, we'll be reviewing some of the week's big releases with Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw, including Hellboy 2 and Jonathan Demme's documentary on the trials of former President Jimmy Carter. But first, Baltasar Kormákur broke onto the international scene in 2000 with his film 101 Reykjavik, a modish slacker love story set in his native Iceland. Since then, he's gone on to write and direct several features, most notably 2005's A Little Trip to Heaven, starring Forest Whitaker. Baltasar was in the UK this week to promote his new film, Jar City, which is out in mid-September. It's perhaps best described as an Icelandic film noir. It stars Ingvar Sigurðsson as a homicide cop investigating a murder that then uncovers a rat's nest of buried secrets. And when you consider that Iceland has a population of only about 300,000, it's small wonder that this is a place where everyone knows one another's business and where your best friend might be related to your worst enemy. And Baltasar Kormákur joins us now in the Film Weekly studio. Baltasar Kormákur, the cliché of the film noir is that they take place in an anonymous, lonely, impersonal environment, but Jar City is very different.
Well, you know, in some ways, yeah, but it's just my country, which is kind of a lonely place, you know, with so few people. Mm. But yeah, it does happen a lot in the city. So it's not, out in a tundra or, a house or something like that.
There's a great line near the very start of the film when the detective Erlander refers to the crime as being a very Icelandic murder, messy and pointless.
Yeah.
Is this a particular Icelandic speciality?
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, Jar City kind of broke the ice also for, thrillers in Iceland, because nobody actually believed that you could set a thriller in Iceland. Lack of crimes, lack of reason for crimes, and therefore, if you had a murder, it usually wasn't prepared and wasn't... You couldn't make a whole thriller about it because it's just somebody who got drunk and killed the wife with a bottle or something. So there was so the murders in Iceland are kind of easy to find out and they're messy and the corpse is there. So there's nothing to do, and that's what he's talking about. That this looks like typical Icelandic murder.
This is the thing that although you might say that the typical Icelandic crime is self-contained and easily solved, this is a crime that basically probes Icelandic culture and the particular claustrophobic, self-contained nature of Iceland as a society.
Yeah, and that's why it has a time and a place, but a strong sense of it. And I really wanted to make it as Icelandic, as possible, in the sense, because it has a genre element, which is a thriller and a police procedure, but to me, it's more a drama and about people.
I remember seeing your first film, 101 Reykjavik, which focused on the city's, at the time, sort of burgeoning youth culture. And I think was made in involvement with Damon Albarn, who was living
exactly,
there.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, this is a very different Iceland that we see here.
Yeah. 101 Reykjavik is one of the things that kind of pushed that Icelandic being cool. Mm. And I didn't do it to make it look cool. It became like a Trainspotting in England. It became an ambassador for a certain culture.
Is it fair to say that you have a love-hate relationship with Iceland? Which is the real Iceland for you?
I think it's like a difficult but very intense marriage. You love it and you hate it at the same time. I say that people that have the opportunity, like I've had recently and through my film career, to go other places and work, and come back and choose to go there and work, it's heaven. Mm. But if you cage there and you can't go out of there, it's like a cell. Mm. Because, it's 300,000 people. You have to be able to go and come back.
Your last film before this was Little Trip to Heaven, which was made in the English language with the Hollywood stars Forest Whitaker and Julia Stiles. Was that a good experience for you?
It was a very good experience. That's actually is done in Iceland, and it's in a similar way. It was a very good experience and quite interesting. And actually, in some ways, also to appreciate what you have, the actors that I have aren't any worse. They are maybe less known, but they are just as good. And I just made a film now in New Mexico, which is going to be with Sam Shepard and Dan Kruger and Dermot Mulroney. Great international cast. It's fantastic, but it doesn't mean that I'm going anywhere. It's just, you know, if I get a good story, I might do that. But you're so rooted to your own country that you don't feel that there is anything better out there anyway.
And finally, Baltasar, I have to ask, one of the quirks of the lead character in Jar City is his favourite dish is sheep's head, which he eats eyeball and all.
Yeah.
Is this a common delicacy in Iceland?
Well, it used to be and is for my generation and older people, but, you know, the younger people are not so keen on it. And I tell you, the great thing, well, my wife loves it. She's a very fancy woman and she loves to go and have a takeaway sheep head.
And how about you? Do you like it?
Yeah, I like it, yeah. I eat it regularly. You know, it's not my favorite dish, but I do eat it. And the eye is particularly good. And I tell you, that what happened when the film came out, because what people find disgusting in other countries actually think that delicious in Iceland, is that the sheep head sales went up 300%. It was on the cover of one of the papers in Iceland that sheep heads had gone up 300% in sales because of Jar City.
It's a lot of mutton farmers that owe you their livelihood there.
Well, yeah, you know, they treat me well. I live in the country myself. I live in a farm.
But this is why you've got to stick working with Icelandic actors. You're not going to get a Hollywood actor to eat a sheep's eyeball. It's not going to happen.
They'll probably put some jelly, candy in the eye and make it look like other than having eaten it.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Baltasar Kormákur, thank you so much for joining us in the Film Weekly podcast studio. And best of luck with Jar City, which is a terrific film and is out very soon.
My pleasure.
And Baltasar Kormákur's film Jar City is on release across the UK from September the 12th. Coming up, we have an extended interview with director Gurinder Chadha, recorded by Jason Solomons as part of the In the Director's Chair series, that you can also view at guardian.co.uk/video. But first, we welcome the great Peter Bradshaw, The Guardian's film critic, into the studio to guide us through some of the other releases out this week. Peter, let's start with the biggest behemoth of the week, which is Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. This is Guillermo del Toro's second stab at the comic book fantasy franchise about a hulking, beer-loving monster who saves the world from, I think, lots of other monsters. Let's hear a clip of that now.
Now, for the first time at auction, a piece of the royal crown of Bethmora, coming to us from a long-lost culture.
Lost?
Not at all. Forgotten by you, perhaps. Very... very much alive.
Who are you, sir? Sir, please identify yourself. You can't just...
I am Prince Nuada, Silver Lance, son of King Balor. And I am here, sir, to reclaim what is rightfully mine.
Security! Call security!
Sit down! Proud, empty, hollow things that you are.
Let this remind you why you once feared the dark.
Peter, are you a Hellboy fan?
Yes, I am a Hellboy fan. I came away from Hellboy 2 enjoying it and liking it in the exact same way that I liked the first one, which I'd forgotten about, which is that it's funny and a lot of people don't realise it, and there is a kind of massive kind of fanboy demographic constituency who kind of don't see it either, I suspect, or at least they kind of slant the press coverage away from that. But Hellboy is kind of funny. And I've got to confess to being kind of agnostic in a way about Pan's Labyrinth, Guillermo del Toro's last film, which, although it looked wonderful, I thought it had a kind of strange, I am now being so serious, pompousness to it, dare I say, which Hellboy never has. Hellboy is always exactly as imaginative, exactly as kind of visionary as Pan's Labyrinth, but isn't quite so up itself, quite frankly, and is funny.
You're kind of flying in the face of critical wisdom with that, because Guillermo del Toro is seen as a director who kind of manages his career in a very clever way, and
yes.
that he will go off and make a little personal acclaimed film like Pan's
yeah.
Labyrinth, and then he will, for want of a better term, sell out with something like
yes.
Hellboy. But you're seeing it in a completely opposite way.
Sort of, although there was nothing little about Pan's Labyrinth. It was a very, very high production value expensive movie. I would imagine as expensive and as well publicised in a way as Hellboy, although probably not as lucrative, and very similar in a way, because the production design, the creature effects work is very, very similar, with real trademark effects on it now, something which we can recognise as being absolutely Guillermo del Toro, all the kind of weird, great, big, bulbous beasts with the tiny little eyes on their kneecaps, or whatever it is. I, as I say, at the risk of giving offence, I have to say I was unconvinced by Pan's Labyrinth, and I thought there was almost something slightly M. Night Shyamalan about it, whereas Hellboy is funny. I mean, Ron Perlman is a great comic performance. He's giving a great comic performance, and there are kind of really funny things about it, which are funnier because you kind of don't expect them to come, in a way. You don't expect it to be like that. There's a great scene in it where Abe and Hellboy start singing along kind of drunkenly and maudlinly to Barry Manilow's Can't Smile Without You. It's really good. It's really funny.
And is this what kind of differentiates it from the other big superhero blockbusters, this kind of vein of humour?
Yes, I would say that. It's not as ironically, it doesn't have the ironic torsion of the usual superhero comedy, which is a superhero comedy at its own expense. There's lots of comedy about the fact that we've all grown up with Superman and we've all grown up with Spider-Man. For example, in Spider-Man 3 or Spider-Man 2, Peter Parker walks around and sees hears some busker playing on a scrapey violin the theme from the old TV show. That is the superhero movie's conventional idea of comedy. Mm. It's a comedy at its own expense.
And it's kind of knowing geek humor.
It's knowing geek humor, saying, golly, gee, do you remember how we used to watch these stupid shows and how cool we are now? That's the kind of humor. Whereas the humor in Hellboy seems to be completely different. It seems to arise in a more left-field way, but in a more plausible and if this doesn't sound too obtuse, kind of human way than that. It seems to be that Hellboy, he seems to have very human emotions for Liz, his girlfriend. And I found myself identifying in a way with Hellboy.
apart from having the pointy tail.
Apart from having the pointy tail. Well, he's kind of, I mean, I'm not as big as Hellboy, but I'm, you know, I'm as unfit in many ways.
I was at the screening too, and I, like you, I enjoyed this a huge amount. In the end, though, it got a bit too much. Like, I love the scene in the troll market, but there's only so many sort of fairy tale monsters that you can cope with. And this just kind of lays it on. It's almost like having a rich meal with almost too many courses.
Yes, I agree with that. It is a very rich meal, but I found that the kind of levels of humor, levels of humanity acted as a kind of sorbet between the courses for me. I found there was just as much density of invention there, certainly as much as Pan's Labyrinth. But it was always leavened and dissolved in a way with humour and a kind of waywardness that I really liked.
That's Hellboy 2. And let's now kind of move to the absolute opposite end of the spectrum with Jonathan Demme's documentary Jimmy Carter, The Man from Plains. But before we discuss this film, Peter, let's first hear a clip.
Former President Jimmy Carter is responding to the controversy flaring over his new bestseller on the Middle East.
Well, I want it to be both accurate and somewhat provocative.
Freedom comes with consequences. Shout out
from the boot to the inner city. Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for your courage.
Thank you. There hadn't been a single day of peace talks in the Holy Land in 6 years. Not many people know it or care. I care.
Is this a compelling portrait of the former president?
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this. It tells a fascinating story. I wonder if it was the story that Jonathan Demme thought he was going to get. I wondered if he thought he was going to get a movie which is a bit like Al Gore's environmentalism, something pretty low-key, something everybody was going to agree with. Instead, he got something very different. What happened was he went on tour with Jimmy Carter promoting his 2006 book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Now, in that title, there are two words which will infuriate pro-Israelis, of which the word apartheid is the second most infuriating.
Yes.
I've become interested in the way that, of all the insults they're getting thrown at Israel, apartheid is now kind of sticking in a way. Yeah, people used to say, oh, you're just like Nazis, which was too extreme and too stupid, really. Whereas I think the anti-Israeli movement, in a way, has suddenly realized that apartheid is a very, very effective kind of insult because it's just smaller scale enough to get under their skin, to get under Israel's skin. And I think this strategy may have been invented, in a way, by Jimmy Carter. Anyway, it shows Carter clearly knowing that his book is contentious, it's controversial, and there are lots of very, very timid and cautious and even terrified TV stations who almost can't believe that they are giving the Palestinian cause an easy ride. They can't believe that they are being asked, in a way, to even give it 50% of the debate. And they are always nervously and timidly asking the ex-president to split the difference with his opponents on this issue. And he repeatedly and interestingly declines to do this. I think Carter was a little taken aback by just how ferocious the opposition to his book was. And that comes across very interestingly in the movie. He asks to give a speech at Brandeis University. Brandeis, clearly terrified of being associated with this cause, just simply declined to do it. How extraordinary that an ex-president is told to bugger off by Brandeis University. But that's what happened. And then they said they would only do it if he shared the podium, of course, because there's no question of just letting him say what he thinks. There's no question of that. He had to share the podium with one of the most belligerent and bellicose pro-Israel commentators, Alan Dershowitz.
He's trying to kind of forge a different kind of role for himself, doesn't he? I mean, yeah. Traditionally, ex-presidents play the kind of grandee. They're above the debate. They're kind of revered and respected and don't get kind of down and dirty. But he's sort of going a different way.
Yes.
But at the same time, I guess, hoping that he will be still accorded that kind of respect.
Yes. Oh, yes. I think he certainly was. He thought there was respect due to his grey hairs. There was respect due to him as the legendary author of the Camp David Accord. He clearly, as a man, he's in his 80s now, he clearly feeds off the global adulation. I mean, he has an extraordinary itinerary. He's never off the plane. He goes from country to country, and he is worshipped wherever he goes. And clearly, you can see that it's kind of keeping him alive in a way, because he's still very hale and hearty.
What was your own view of Carter after watching this film? Did you like him more than you did, or not?
I found myself liking him more than I did, because I realised that what we are watching is a dramatic and interesting part of his life. It's not just watching Al Gore giving his environmental kind of PowerPoint speech, excellent though that is. He's actually thought that he would more or less get away with it, that he would get some criticism but get away with it because he's above the fray. And then you see that this is turning into the nastiest time for him, in a way, since the Iranian hostage crisis. This is a really dramatic part of his time. And I think he handles it with a good deal of sang-froid, more than I think anybody would, because he's not, as an ex-president, he has a certain amount of protection and lots of kind of ancillary staff and support staff, but not as many as a serving politician. And he does handle it with a certain grace and charm. And he's got some style. He's got some class.
Now, Jimmy Carter isn't the only American superstar lending his vision to the Israel-Palestine debate this week, is it?
Yes. Yes. Through a remarkable serendipity that we sometimes see in the release schedules, there is another film about the Israel-Palestine conflict, and that is by the great thinker Adam Sandler, who is playing a character called the Zohan.
Because I've been waiting for many years to hear Sandler's take on this
Yes,
issue.
Exactly. Well, Adam Sandler has in fact, alluded to his Judaism many times in a kind of almost semi-serious way in his movies, but this is the first time he's got stuck into the Israel question.
Well, hang on, just hold it there for a moment, Peter, because we need to listen to a clip of the mighty Zohan in action.
Mrs. Paulsen, I must tell you, when you first came in, you looked hideous. There was nothing attractive about you, but now I must say, my schnitzel is about to burst. It could break things.
What are you doing?
We are talking shop.
No. No. Look, Coco.
What?
You need to calm down now. Okay, I don't think these customers like the way you talk shop.
Nobody say this.
Coco.
Yes?
Remember, respect for the workplace.
I have betrayed my salon.
Oh, he's trying to kill himself!
Happy.
I deserve this.
Easy on the ladies.
I didn't mind.
This is a kind of movie. It's kind of crass and silly, but there are lots of good gags in it. And it is a recurrent bee in my bonnet in that the critical classes do not give comedies, especially broad comedies, they don't give them an even break in a way that almost every other genre in the cinema is treated with endless kind of indulgence. You know, rubbish action movies and rubbish rom-coms are tolerated by, you know, a reasonable minority of them. But comedies, for some reason, no. Adam Sandler, he has this kind of dopey, kind of good-hearted kind of idea that he is this badass Israeli commando who is loved and feared in Israel because of the tough way he handles terrorists. Even talking that way about terrorists will make the liberal classes in this country kind of faint with horror and bristle with disgust. But anyway, that's how it's phrased. But he really wants to be a hairstylist. Underneath that macho exterior, he wants to be a gentle hairstylist in the manner of a kind of 80s Paul Mitchell-style crimper. Mm. And so he heads to the United States, he heads to New York to follow his dream. And, of course, the only place he can get a job is in a Palestinian-owned salon. And that's where the kind of liberal humanist cop-out is right. going to come. Right. But not before we've had some kind of pretty crass, dopey, and sometimes very funny gags.
So if a film goer really wanted to get to grips with this issue, yes. And they can only see one film, they're both playing at rival multiplexes, which one would you recommend?
I think you would probably want to go with You Don't Mess With the Zohan, because it will give you a much clearer insight into the Israeli and pro-Israeli mindset than I think Jimmy Carter's.
And I guess Carter doesn't do much of the hairstyling either.
He doesn't do much of the hairstyling, although his hair is still with us. Which is more than I can say for mine. So there we are.
Peter Bradshaw, thank you very much. Thanks again there to Peter Bradshaw, and you can read all of Peter's reviews at guardian.co.uk/film. And a recent addition to the site is a series of interviews with leading directors called In the Director's Chair with Jason Solomons. First in the hot seat is the British-Asian director Gurinder Chadha, brains behind the likes of Bend It Like Beckham and the current Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging.
Welcome to In the Director's Chair, a new series here on guardian.co.uk. I'm Jason Solomons, and I'm with Gurinder Chadha, my first interviewee for this new series. We're at the Curzon Soho on the eve of the opening of your new film, Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging.
Yes.
It's an exciting time when a movie's about to open for a director, and you're, I think, unique on the British circuit in that you do everything, you sell it, and then you go out like an old huckster in the Old West. Is that what a film needs?
I think so. In these days, yes, marketing is paramount, actually, and Hollywood films have huge publicity machines behind them, and often British films suffer in that respect.
When you started out directing, you can never quite know where it's going to take you. But did you have a certain style in mind? Did you think, well, this is the sort of director I am? I don't know, when you first took up the camera, did you think, well, my influence is I'm obviously going to make a film like Scorsese, or I'm obviously going to make a film like Satyajit Ray? I don't know. Where did you come to the whole thing from?
Well, I have a very different trajectory, I think, to a lot of film directors, in that I came to it really via politics. I, at university, I did a course in third world economics and politics, and I always thought I would end up working for Oxfam or something like that. But in my final year, I did a dissertation on images of women in the media, and that kind of really opened my eyes. And I realised how powerful the visual medium was, and newspapers and magazines and television, and I just was amazed that I'd never really thought about the world in this way before. And then I did a documentary as my first film for the BFI, for the British Film Institute. And that was very journalistically driven, but the voice was very much the voice of a new generation, a second generation British Asian voice. And that film was I'm British But... And it was about me basically discussing Britishness and identity, and using Bhangra music as well as interviews. And it was really that, the fact that I kind of made a mark with this voice, that then made people in the filmmaking community say, OK, we need to encourage this. And it's really thanks to people like Karen Bambra, actually, who used to be at Film 4, you know, that I was really taken... I was able to even conceive of going down the path of making a feature film. Because I then started the development of Barge on the Beach.
Yes, which came as a breath of fresh air as well, bracing breath of fresh air as it was set by the seaside.
Yes.
And again, I mean, the twin, it seems to fit with Angus and Thongs because it's got that seaside feel to it, which is clearly where you seem to find a sort of fascination with the very Britishness of Britain. It seems to come into full relief in the seaside, and then you throw kind of a bunch of Asian women on a seaside outing rushing down towards the beach, and that's a sort of heady cultural mix that happens in Bargee.
Yes, at that time, I mean, for me, the seaside was England, very, very English. I mean, you hardly ever saw any Indian people or black people at the coast, you know. So for me, seaside meant white English. Urban areas meant multicultural in Britain. And so we set the film in Blackpool precisely for that reason and took our coachload of Indian women into that area. And when I made the film, I just thought I'll never, ever make another film again. I better do everything with this one and say everything I want to say. And it really was a baptism by fire because I'd basically done a short film course at the film school and I had done a short feature, fiction. And I hadn't really had any other training. So I really was learning on the job as I went along. And I learned a lot, you know, by the end of the shoot, I'd learned so much more than the very beginning. But it is amazing what you learn. And I think there are sometimes now when I watch Bargee on the Beach, I mean, I wanted to do this whole thing where one of the actresses, one of the characters would go off into these Bollywood dreams, you know, where she kind of was trying to deal with the modernising of the Asian community.
The one who's thinking about leaving her husband.
Yes, yeah, Lalita, Asha, the character. And I think the way I go in and out of those Bollywood sequences is very clumsy, and now when I look at it, I kind of like cringe and I go, oh my god, you know, because it's not exactly smooth, you know. But on the other hand, it works, you know. It's very much a first feature. I mean, its heart's in the right place, and you know, the performances are great. It looks good, I think.
And it does have those moments that have the kind of swoop to them, simply because you've got wide vistas, I suppose, at the sea.
Yes.
But, you know, you do hang back, and when they all do charge down to that sea.
Yeah, that's lovely.
It's a very uplifting and heartwarming moment.
Yes, that's lovely.
And yeah. I noticed that it does reoccur in Angus as well, when the girls...
yes, running down, yes. You're right, yes, I didn't think of that. Yeah.
That's why you need critics to remind you.
I'm making the same film over and over again.
But it took a while after Bargee on the Beach for you to make another film, and that does seem to happen a lot to British filmmakers. Have a great first film, it's well received, and then something happens for 5-6 years, we don't hear of them again. What were you doing?
Well, the expectations that I think are put on them to do perhaps the same thing again, you know, especially if the film's been well received. I mean, Bargee was critically well received and financially, you know, made more money than a lot of British films at that time, even though it was only released on about 5 prints or something. I think that if the film was released today, I think it would be a very different story because the British cinema-going audience is very different now. I think that the problem I had was that I wanted to do something else, but I wanted to do something that perhaps, you know, wasn't the same as Bargee on the Beach. And so it took ages and ages and ages to develop things. And then, you know, then once you developed it, you know, the people who were running the channel at the time changed. And I mean, there was all kinds of stuff going on. And I didn't make another film for about 6 years, despite trying really hard.
And you had to go to the US for that.
Well, I'd met Paul, my husband by then, and my co-writer. In fact, we met just after Bargee, and we had been working on a script in LA, because Bargee did really well in America, and it's quite a cult film in America. And so I started getting offered all kinds of things in America pretty much immediately.
Yeah, that sort of upsets me that the offers come from America rather than here.
Yeah, well, that's because they make a lot more films over there than we do here. But I kind of didn't like any of the scripts I was reading, and so I said to Paul, well, if they want me to make a film here, why don't we sit down and write the kind of film I would want to make? So I made a very British film about LA and What's Cooking. It follows 4 families on Thanksgiving, and you kind of go into the lives of these 4 families, But the difference is the four families are Latin American, one Jewish American, African American, and Vietnamese American. And we intercut between the two. So it's a very British idea, actually.
Yeah, it's a movie you can smell as well. I mean, food movies always do quite well anyway. But
yes.
All that spice in there. And it was the first time I realised watching your work had what a Jewish filmmaker you
yeah.
are as well.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
But I mean, obviously that
yeah, because all the families could have been Jewish. They could have all been Indian. They could all have been Mexican. They could have been, you know, we're all the same, really. It's just that we use different spices, perhaps.
Yes, it's a beautiful film. And again, it sort of did okay here in the UK. Mm. I think maybe it was too ethnically flavoured, perhaps, for UK audiences.
Yeah, maybe. I think people didn't quite know what it was either.
It's a mix of comedy and also kind of arguments and bitterness as well. I mean, it's all in there.
I think people didn't realise it was made by a British person. I think had it been sold as a British movie about America, I think it would have been different.
Yeah. But, I mean, when you came back, you were clearly a better filmmaker for having made Bargee than having made
yes.
What's Cooking. And then you could really attack, which I suppose is the film that put you on the map, is Bend It Like Beckham.
Yes. But even Bend It Like Beckham, I mean, I still hadn't been very successful to that point. I mean, I'd managed to sort of make a second movie, Kicking and Screaming. But with Bend It Like Beckham, that still took about 5 years to get that financed. I mean, you know, that was a long haul. And very few people really believed in that. Most people felt that no one wanted to see a film about an Indian girl who wants to play football.
Really? Sounds, you know, Gregory's Girl was such a sort of hit around that,
yeah.
that sort of theme.
Yeah.
And it seemed like a very good idea to me.
Everyone passed on it. Everyone. Even now, people come up to me, you know, people in quite high positions of power, and say, OK, well, we messed up, you know. I mean, working title, Eric Fellner has said that to me once. He said, you know, now, OK, you've proved to us all you're a very clever girl. We got it wrong. What are you going to do next? Come and work with us.
But it's a very force of nature sort of movie. Perminda Nagra, who plays the girl who wants to play football, is a force of nature in it. And it does have that kind of feisty female making her own way because everyone's saying no to her, which
yes.
obviously, as you say now, reveals what was going on outside of that.
Yes, absolutely,
you.
Absolutely.
So is that anger there? Is that why it's such a sort of forceful,
yes.
crazy movie?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, again, when I made that film, I had no idea it was going to be as huge as it was. So I just put everything into it again because I thought, well, I might not be able to make another film for another decade or something. So, you know, I guess that's why it has that sense of urgency and that real sense of, like, it's now or never. It's got to happen, you know. And you get swept up in that, really.
Because, I mean, that you're in it, you have your little cameo.
Yeah.
I mean, there's dancing in it. There's great football movement and swiftness.
Well, it's a celebration. I mean, I think that's really the best way to describe Bend It Like Beckham, is it's a celebration about being British and Asian. And what I really love about the film is that it really goes into the minutiae of how we negotiate different sides of ourselves, how we negotiate being Indian and being English and being sort of sometimes having to be a bit traditional with our parents, but then being sort of completely the opposite, you know, when we're with our mates.
One of the extraordinary things about Beckham was that it kept on playing throughout the summer. You know, a lot of British films have a very short release and then people don't go and see them, but yours kept going and it brought different audiences over that journey from mums and dads to kind of, you know, my mates who were going, oh, I've got to see a football movie and see if Keira Knightley can actually play football, see if this Indian girl is any good. And she was quite useful.
It was a classic word of mouth movie. I think it was a classic film where you don't think it's for you, but actually it's totally for you, whoever you are. I think it's that kind of movie. And my favourite story about Beckham, really, I went to a screening in Manchester and I was going to do a Q&A after, and I arrived at the cinema and they told me that it was so sold out that they had to open the neighbouring cinema as well. And I thought, wow, God, Manchester. I said, the Asian community has come out in force. And then I got there and it was like predominantly white, hardly an Asian face around. And it was at that point, because this is just before the film opened, it was at that point I thought, okay, something's going on here. I wasn't anticipating this. Something else is going on here. It's somehow part of the zeitgeist. It's sort of like locked into something going on in British culture right now. And so I introduced the film and there were all these sort of grandmas there with their kids and grandkids and mums and dads and, you know, people who bought food from home. It was that kind of cinema. And and I sort of talked a bit, and no one quite knew who I was, what I was doing there, because, you know, you don't really do directors of, up in Manchester like this. I guess not many people had done it for this kind of audience. Anyway, I finished talking, and then, you know, this sort of grandma sort of waved at me and said, "Oh, you're dead clever, ain't you? You're dead clever." Anyway, I walked off, and at the end of the film, I was there at the end, and people were coming out, and people were smiling. And then there was this one English woman who came up to me, and she must have been in her 30s, and she had white stilettos on and white trousers, I remember. And she'd been crying, and she said, "You know, I've got to talk to you." And I said, "Of course, you know." And she said, "You think you've made a comedy, don't you?" And I said, "Yeah, well, it is funny. It's supposed to be funny in places." And she said, "No." She says, "What you've done, you don't know what you've done for those of us who live around here." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "Because of the Oldham riots and what had been going on in Manchester lately," she said, "what you've done is you've shown us that everyone wants the best for their kids. Doesn't matter who you are, everyone's going to fight to get the best for their kids." And I just, like, came over, like, completely emotional at that point. And for me, you know, I mean, she was obviously referring to the fact that the communities were sort of killing each other, and that suddenly, by watching the film, she had seen the whole Asian community up there in a completely different light. And that, to me, was really... that made it all worth it for me, for being in films and doing what I do.
That goes back to when you thought about women in the power and the media.
Absolutely.
What you can do.
Absolutely.
I suppose it's extraordinary because as a director, you think you know, especially you think, you know, you're in command, you kind of get a good title, it's quite savvy, you can go and market it. But there are things that you make when you create films or you create art that people take away from them that you can have no dominion over, that you can have no control over. Mm. Does that continually fascinate you? Because you sit there on sets and you set up every shot and you think, well, you've covered all the bases and you know what you're doing, but something about a work like that, something that you're writing, that you're putting into it, means a lot to so many different people. I always think as a director that must be an extraordinary thing to get back.
It's the most wonderful thing in the world, you know. I mean, my favourite film is It's a Wonderful Life, you know, and I watch it every Christmas and I cry my eyes out, you know, and I know it's all going to work out in the end, but I still go through the motions. And something about that movie really goes to the very heart, because it's talking about the essence of humanity, and it's talking about you know, life not always being smooth, you know, being hard and people struggling, and that at the end of the day, we've all got to be there for each other, you know. And that's, I love that sentiment. And for me, with the way I approach a film and make it, at the end of the day, you know, what I love is when an audience sort of sits there with a sense of camaraderie around them, that they've all been on this journey together and they've all laughed at the same things. They've all kind of really experienced it emotionally, collectively. And they all relate to the characters and to each other in a different way after. I don't know if I'm making sense, but I mean, that to me is what I love, is the fact that someone in the Valley in LA can have exactly the same experience as someone in Salford in Manchester. And it's that universal emotion, but really sort of very sweet, succinct, efficient, right to the heart kind of emotion that I try and go for. And then when people respond to that, that really makes me feel good.
Well, thank you very much for coming on In the Director's Chair, the first episode of. I wish you many more visits to In the Director's Chair, because if you keep making movies, we'll keep having to have you back. But it's been an absolute pleasure to see you, Gurinder Chadha. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jason.
That's all we have time for this week. For all the latest film reviews and news, go to guardian.co.uk/film. I'm Zan Brooks, my producer was Jason Phipps, and we're now off to tuck in to a fine dish of sheep's eyeballs.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.